From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
Morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. So I'm quite... thank you, IFN, for having us over here. I'm personally also very grateful and honored to have such an esteemed panel here. And I was going through their biographies, as I'm sure you would be. Individually, they have more than 20 years, two decades of experience, a lot of them in Islamic finance industry. So it's very gratifying to be a moderator for this session. I'm Nitish Bhojnagarwala, Senior Vice President with Moody's Investor Service, and I manage the GCC banking and Islamic finance for Moody's. So before we start, I have an opening question, and I wouldn't really introduce the panel. I would request you, while answering the opening question, if you can also introduce yourself. So in the context of Southeast Asia, what is the key current dynamic characterizing the Islamic financial services sector? So if we can start from Shariman, if you can please introduce yourself and then give us a little bit of what you think is the key current dynamic shaping and characterizing the Islamic financial services sector.
Thank you. Thanks, Itish. Assalamu alaikum and good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming today. And I'm quite happy to see the turnout despite, you know, the Monday morning traffic and so on and the four-day weekend. Let me just introduce myself briefly. My name is Shariman. I look after the group Islamic banking business of CIMB Group. And for Islamic banking, our major markets are basically Malaysia, Indonesia, and to some extent, Singapore. I think, Nitish, maybe today, starting on your starting question, the trends that we're seeing or what's happening in the region. So the way maybe I'll structure my opening remarks is that I'll try to answer it separately between the two markets, the two primary markets, which is Malaysia and Indonesia. And then maybe we'll go through some of the underlying factors or trends that we are seeing at the moment in the respective markets. From our perspective, or from my personal perspective, Malaysia, I would say that we are coming to that middle age syndrome. Well, you know, coming to that 50, I think DG was saying about the share of book was about 45-46% and so on. I think eventually we're going to get to around that 50% level. And definitely for CIMB Islamic, we are aspiring to reach that 50% share of book level. And I think as you reach 50s, you know, what's next? So last time people say life begins at 40, now is like, what do you do once you reach 50 and onwards? So that is actually the kind of thing. So we are actually dealing, from my perspective in Malaysia, it's a mature market. Albeit we still have some structural issues that we need to fix, but we got to figure out everything until what's the way forward. So first position is that the low-hanging fruits are done. I mean, whatever low-hanging fruits, I think the Islamic banking industry, we have been diligently cultivating all the low-hanging fruits. So now really is how do we move forward by differentiating and also creating value? And I think my main point is always like, how do we continue to be relevant? You can only create value by being relevant. Three trends that we are seeing in the Malaysian market. And number one, I think, and this is where the areas, opportunities where we think we can make a difference is number one, the demographics. So even on the demographic population of Malaysia, you can see it's aging. And I think there is an inherent need of the community, which is on the estate planning side. So various statistics have been thrown about and so on. But I think one unmet area for the Muslim community in Malaysia specifically, right, is actually on the Islamic estate planning, the inheritance side and so on. We have about 90 billion that's stuck, and that number keeps growing. And I think as the population keeps aging, that's a big area that I don't think there's a clear solution out there for the users on. We actually did our own market survey. Top of mind for most Muslims now in Malaysia is not so much about how to create my wealth, but how to make sure that when I pass away, the distribution it can be done smoothly. So that's first top of mind. The second one, Nitish, is actually the changing nature of work. I think there's a lot more people are now self-employed. So I think the statistics are showing the growing number, especially post-COVID. How do we make sure that as financial institutions, we support them and through entrepreneurship programs and whatnot, how do we support entrepreneurs? Because generally, the way we are tooled, the banks are tooled, we actually give financing through payslip financing and so on. You have a stable income, we know your credit history and so on. But going forward, we need to have to be more predictive about your ability to honor your commitments in the future. And lastly, of course, what I call this, as what DG was mentioning earlier, this is actually applies for both Malaysia and Indonesia. How do we finance the transition financing? Remember, we have huge NDC commitments, right? We are supposed to reduce by 45% with external support, or not 35%. That's for Malaysia. Indonesia has to go down to about 39% with external support, and about 30% without external support. And we are very far away. So there's massive amount of financing required. I think NETR was trying to allude to that. Sorry, just one more, then I'll just shift to Indonesia. I know you got to pass already. So I think Indonesia is the opposite, slightly different. I think it's a very young, from an Islamic perspective, I think that's a very young population, 7 to 8% share of book. But now it's going to the teens or early teens. And, you know, these are when we are starting to see what's our identity and so on. I think given the level of penetration of banking in Indonesia and the advent of mobile technology, I think digital banking for Islamic in Indonesia is very ripe. I think it's maybe the right place to push for it, because given the low level of penetration. But again, and also secondly, the NET, the transition financing, same problem. Those are also an area for Islamic finance to actually pivot and take advantage of. Sorry, Nitish, more than my 2 minutes.
No, that's absolutely fine. And thank you so much. I think you've already cut to the chase, but we will still go around to the panel. And you've mentioned some very interesting things which we'll explore. But before that, Dr. Bello, key current dynamic characterizing the Islamic financial services sector from your dashboard, which is quite broad. You can actually talk about more on a global level rather than just Southeast Asia, but I'll leave that to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Nitish. I first of all extend my sincere appreciation to IFN for this invitation. It is a great opportunity and honor for me to be here on the stage with extreme panelists like what I have here. I have two of my sisters here and one of my good friend here on the same panel. I think maybe for the benefit of the audience, the Islamic Financial Services Board is an established prudential standard setting body that was established way back in 2003. And then now we are celebrating our 20th anniversary. We currently have 188 member institutions at the in the IFSB, and this comprises of 81 regulatory and supervisory authorities. The most recent regulatory authorities that joined the IFSB membership is the Bank of Russia, that just joined the IFSB as an associate member. In the IFSB membership as well, we have 10 international organizations that include the IMF, the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Islamic Development Bank, the United Nations Development Program. They are all members of the IFSB. We also have 97 market players. This includes all the financial institutions around the globe. Our membership is comprising of all these stakeholders from 58 countries. So perhaps the fact that we are hosted here in Malaysia is a great opportunity for us to share the perspectives in terms of what is in the Southeast Asian region. I believe many are aware that we are hosted by Bank Negara Malaysia in Sasana Kijang. We have been there since establishment, and Malaysia take the lead in establishing the IFSB. And our main mandate is to promote stability and resilience of the global financial service industry through the issuance of prudential standards and facilitating the implementation of such standards. Now, to answer your question, I believe the global total Islamic financial services industry asset is growing year on year, and now standing at about $3.6 trillion. And out of this portion, $757 billion are from the Southeast Asia region alone. So, which is outside the GCC region, the Southeast Asia region constitutes the second largest jurisdiction that has the Islamic financial services industry asset. In terms of the banking sector, yes, as mentioned by Brother Ahmad, Malaysia and Indonesia has been leading the role, and they play significant importance in driving the dynamics for the entire Southeast Asia region because of the robust regulatory framework, the commitment by the financial institution to drive the industry that we have seen over the years. And I think most importantly is the demand of the Islamic financial service industry is really tremendous in this region due to the level of effort of both public awareness and education, consumer education put in by the central bank and the financial institutions. Now, Takaful is also doing great in the sense that in as of 2022 last year, we have seen 7.5 growth in terms of the total asset for Takaful, which is the highest globally, actually. In terms of the asset size, yes, Takaful is still small. It's about 5.4 billion US dollars in terms of the size of the Takaful. But on the ICM side, for the Islamic capital market size, the total outstanding issuances for in year 2022, last year, was actually 41% is coming from the Southeast Asia region. Now, what constitutes and drive these dynamics is more on the proactiveness from the side of all the market players, particularly the financial institutions, and supported by the regulatory institutions. We have seen new initiatives being driven forward by the central bank itself in most of these jurisdictions. And they supported the financial institutions to be able to carry out what has been the focus of the industry. But of course, there are potentials, greater potential for growth in the Islamic financial service industry in the region. We believe outside the GCC, the Southeast Asia region will continue to dominate and lead the global Islamic financial service industry growth. And the drivers mainly, as highlighted, young population, demand for the services, and the continuous robust regulatory framework. These are things that we have seen that will continue to change the dynamic. However, we have seen also really great penetration of digitalization. The commitment by both regulatory authorities and the financial institution to drive the digitalization forward has already created another new change in terms of dynamics. So maybe perhaps we'll discuss more in a later discussion in more details, and then I hope this will be enough for the 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bello. And we will obviously understand better your role in this development of the industry, not only focusing on Southeast Asia, but maybe more broadly as well, if you feel. Dr. Huria, if you can perhaps introduce yourself and just give a two-minute overview on the key current dynamic.
Thank you very much, Nitish, and thank you very much, everyone. Of course, before I start, I should applaud IFN for having this very strong panel. I have my two beloved brothers here, MashaAllah Shariman and Dr. Bello, and of course, my most respectful lecturer, Professor Rusni. So I'm very honored to be here. Thank you very much. Myself is Huria El Islami. Now I'm the CEO and founder of HGC Firm. Well, if you need any connecting with business or people in the APEC region and GCC, well, you know where to find me. I'll provide you with my contact. You can contact IFN, or you can just, you know, quickly grab during the break later on, inshallah. Now, it is great that you have asked Shariman first, because when he shared, I thought like, okay, he took all the point from the industry viewpoint. And then when Dr. Bello said, okay, the regulatory aspect and then standard are done, I have very much less here. And I wouldn't dare talking about Sharia with Prof. Rusni next to me. So let me actually share a bit how the dynamic from the maybe more public, more customers viewpoint. Before the pandemic, I was from the industry myself. I was a banker in Bahrain and Malaysia, covering APEC region, basically. We felt before the dynamic was competition, like at the institutional level, at the national level, even at the region level. We all tried to compete to be the best and to strive for the better. Then come the pandemic. The dynamic change to survival. We all try to survive. And mashallah, I mean, like this region, we are doing it quite well. We survive relatively better than some others. But the other good thing about pandemic, I'm not saying the pandemic was good, but we do learn and we do see those positive things out of the pandemic, because now we have actually left, we abandoned that spirit. We just want to compete against each other, you know, we want to be the better or the best one. We have abandoned that attitude. Now we are exactly, in fact, well, I didn't have prior discussion with Shariman, but exactly the same word that I'll be using, relevant. So those big players are striving to remain relevant, and those who are new to industry or, you know, still in the mid-size, they have to be relevant now. Why? Because of the fast changing pace of the technology, the change of the customer's experience and expectation, and of course the demography. I'm not going to explore that. Shariman has done it in great detail. The issue of the security, the regulation and all this, it has to be to remain relevant, because now, especially for the in the Islamic finance industry, the banks' competitors are not just other banks. When it comes to lending, when it comes to financing, you have stiffer competition now from non-banking institutions. If anyone of you happen to come to Indonesia, for example, the moment you get the coverage for your telephone number, for your phone coverage, I will not be surprised if you will be bombarded by SMS offering you lending. They don't even know who you are. So this is also the challenge for the regulator, because, you know, now not only the bank who offer lending, not only banks offer financing, fintech company is there, they are regulated, although it may not be as regulated as the banks, but out of that, many institutions that previously, many companies that previously offering services are now into lending. So when you have this, but at the same time, you know, when you have so many institutions offering lending and they are not regulated, this is actually a threat to the customer, to the public, which they do not realize yet, because they do not know exactly what they are actually committing into when they are offered, okay, only 1% rate. They thought it's 1% per year, not knowing it's 1% per 2 weeks, 1% per month. And then all they know, they thought, oh, I just borrowed 10 million rupiah, for example, ended up paying triple of that. They didn't know all this, and the regulator cannot regulate either, or have not regulated yet. So it's for Shariman and the colleague from the industry. The thing is, you see, I mean, like with all this, some countries still have those regulations that may actually increase the cost of funding in lending, in financing, because at the end of the day, you can be a big bank. Oh, I'm with the public, you know, now that I'm helping businesses to grow. I've met people who are desperate just to create the bank record, but they found it hard, because in some countries, in Asia especially, the regulation are not that friendly yet to these small, medium enterprises. To those, Shariman did mention, you know, many people are actually doing their own business now. How they are going to grow? They end up taking this unregulated funding, which actually is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. The rate itself doesn't make sense. But that's the thing, you know, when it's not well governed, of course, you are taking such a risk, you are increasing the rate. That's the consequence. But most of us, most of the public do not know this. So that's the challenge. That's the dynamic. We must remain relevant, because at the end of the day, whoever we are, whether you are Muslim or non-Muslim, only 8%, based on our last statistic, only 8% of people doing Islamic banking because they are being a Muslim. The 92% not because of that. So you have to create that value proposition. And now the value proposition is not just about services. It's not just about pricing. It's not just about customer experience. Not just about options. But it's all of those. Thank you.
Thank you. I think while there is a question of relevance that we'll explore, I think one thing, the number that you mentioned towards the end, from our perspective, when we look at it, we publish several research pieces, and in one of them, we always highlight how Islamic finance is underrepresented. And you mentioned 8%. I think from our perspective, it's even less than 8%. It's less than 5%. So that presents huge potential. And I think we are still in an early stage. And we still need to address a lot of things before the question of relevance. But interestingly, we will explore how you get there and how, as practitioners, Shariman and Dr. Bello, how do we as industry professionals address the question of relevance as well? But before we do that, Dr. Rusni, if you can give your introduction and a brief overview, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nitish. Thank you very much. First, of course, Ashukrulillah by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that all of us are here today with the blessings of Allah. And thank you very much for organizing for IFN, for inviting me to be sitting in front together with very highly distinguished speakers and moderators today, and addressing many my friends and colleagues, as well as participants that may be the first time that we have met here. Okay, thank you very much for the questions. Let me introduce myself. I'm Rusni Hassan. I'm the Dean of IIUM Institute of Islamic Banking Finance. We are a center of excellence on teaching and learning, as well as consultancy on Islamic banking and finance. Our institute offer postgraduate programs, master's and PhD in Islamic finance, as well as professional certificates for industry practitioners. As of now, we have more than 400 students who are actively doing master's and PhD, and 700 proud alumni of our institution, of which I'm proud to say that Dr. Bello is one of our alumni. Alhamdulillah, I'm very blessed by that. Now, I'm the only, slightly different because I come from educator's perspective. And I'm proud to be the educators, or Islamic finance educators. Now, coming to the questions on what are the key drivers, what are the key, as of now, I can see that number one is that there's a lot of focus now on value. Value-based financial institutions, value-based intermediation, value-based financial, and a lot of things. Now, we are coming back to the very fundamental questions that we have been talking since from the very beginning of Islamic finance. And this value is given a different names. Previously, it was, if you go through the development, we are talking about, there's a lot of debate about Islamicity of Islamic finance, Sharia-based and Sharia. Sharia-based, and you know, there's a lot of questions. And then there's also, it was also come in the form of maqasid previously. And then 2017, in Malaysian context, we start talking about VBI, value-based intermediation. After COVID, a lot of focus on social finance. People are starting to, find the collaborators rather than Islamic finance are doing it alone now. We are talking about blended finance and whatnot. So to me, this is a good values that we can see it a very progressive and transformation in the industry, in Islamic finance industry. Now, there could be an event that have teach us to focus more on Islamic finance. But one thing that is very important for us to highlight is that the maqasid, the value, and what we are giving to the community is always part and parcel of Islamic finance from the very beginning. But it comes, however, in the different term, different focus and whatnot. Now, we are calling it value, okay? So, to us, it's no issue. As long as what we should be doing is that, what is the impact to the community? Not only impact to the industry, to grow the industry, but at the end of the day, we're also talking about, impact to the community as a whole. Now, we are focusing on ESG. Again, we are talking about the value-driven. Now, that is one thing that I can see a good values that come into Islamic finance. People are also talking about Islamic economy now. Previously, Islamic finance and Islamic economy seems to be very much, I do not know, the words we use cannot be blend together. But now we can see that Islamic economy is already in the system. The Islamic economies are already participating actively in Islamic finance. previously maybe these two kind of sectors or these two kind of discipline kind of didn't meet up. So this is a good move, okay, towards the growth and the development of Islamic banking finance. Now, I cannot do without talking about education because I'm representing the educators. Now, there's a lot of focus on Islamic finance education as well. We can see that report, our FDI report on Islamic finance education, we are proud of having such a report on Islamic finance education by Refinitiv, what we call it, that have been producing 2021. That was the first. And then afterward, you know, we can see that Islamic finance is always coming in into the report. Now, we can see that the growth on Islamic finance education is amazing. Now, 2020, the first report stated about 1,000 kind of, no, less than 1,000 Islamic finance education providers. But now we have almost 2,000. Now, previously, it was less than 1,000 or almost 1,000 research papers that have been produced on Islamic finance. But now the numbers is growing almost 400. So it's a very short period of time. We can see that there's a lot of growth. There's a lot of interest on Islamic finance. And I am, as educator, I'm so happy to see that now industry practitioners are coming to the education. And then they want to do, they want to, what we call it, do their master's and PhD. So, you know, because I always believe that education is the very substance on providing talent, resources on Islamic finance industry. Without a good talent, then, you know, the industry may not get a good support, basically, for the growth and whatnot. So, then again, I'm happy. I'm, as educator, always welcome everyone to do Islamic finance, to pursue your study at a higher level on Islamic finance education. And, of course, all of you are welcome to IIBF, to any part of the world, actually, or Islamic finance education, so that we are growing the industry together. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rusi. And I'm very... it's interesting you mentioned that, because when Dr. Bello was mentioning about the growth in the industry, and he mentioned now Islamic finance industry overall is roughly $3 trillion from very humble beginnings, probably 3 decades ago or 4 decades ago. But the education sector or the talent pool is still lacking, although the numbers have grown, but you can certainly imagine that something which is still not to the levels that we would want compared to the conventional banking system, where you have a very established education and also financial services sector. But I want to pick up on something you mentioned, value-based intermediation, especially for Malaysia. I know this has been there as anchoring also the growth in Islamic finance industry. And maybe if I can start with you, Shariman. This value-based intermediation, what role has this played in shaping Islamic finance industry, particularly in Malaysia? And what can we learn from this, especially looking at the global Islamic finance industry as well?
So, thanks, Nitish. I think on the question of value-based intermediation, so I think there's actually convergence. And in a way, I'm glad that we started that work pre-pandemic, right? So coming back to the trend that I mentioned earlier, the shifting of people from being employed to self-employed and so on. In a way, at least for us, a lot of the work that we have done on the value-based intermediation, whereby at the heart of what we're doing, we put multiple lens just beyond profit when we engage people and so on, engage customers, engage society. Actually, that has put us, number one, allowed us to respond to the pandemic better because we already have partnerships and mechanisms in place to deal with people who are troubled. Right, that's number one. Number two, the work that we started off with some of the institutions like Zakat and Wakaf to actually help entrepreneurs, creation of entrepreneurs, that has actually, as part of value-based intermediation, that has actually helped us fill a gap in the spectrum. So what we saw was, you know, financing is not the most ideal way of finance of solutioning for new entrepreneurs, because if they fail, and the rate of failure for entrepreneurs is really high, it's about 50% and so on, higher than 50%. If you give them financing from the get-go, they don't have experience, they're going to fail, and you're going to saddle them with debt. So the work that we have done with the religious authorities and zakat authorities and so on is to actually give grant-based training and whatnot. And that has actually helped to complete the continuum, the spectrum. So there's grant-based financing for new entrepreneurs among the poor and so on, or people just starting a business. And then that links up when they are more stable, then they go to micro. So we stumble upon the fact that, this is actually a mechanism to help micro entrepreneurs. And then what I call this, to allow them to start something without burdening them. Now, going back to the point of convergence, and I think this is what Dr. Rusni was saying earlier, going back to the spirit or heart of Islamic finance, I think that's what differentiates us, i.e. the desire to really help people, to really help society move forward, either be it the question of inequality, either the question of environment. And I think working with the scholars, we actually have created various frameworks in order to do this. So coming back to your question on VBI, the work on VBI has actually forced the banks to experiment and test out various methods, either to on various areas, either on society or environment. And because we have tested and we work with multiple partners, those are actually, for me, very important learnings that we can actually then accelerate or grow further in the future. We are not there yet. I mean, I think Bank Negara, we always have this discussion of Bank Negara in terms of values and amounts that we are. But I think the work that we've done the last few years are essential for us to create that theoretical framework as the bank shift. And I think this, coming back to Dr. Rusni's point earlier, coming back to our true image or true self, I think that courage for us to come back and embrace what is the role of Islamic financial institution, I think that's part of the process.
So maybe if I can bring Dr. Huria into this conversation as well. I mean, aside from VBI, value-based intermediation, what is it that Malaysia can do in terms of developing the Islamic financial sector? What are the other aspects? Is it the regulatory framework? Are there some sort of challenges that we need to think about? What can be done from a regulatory perspective or from others to expand Islamic finance in Malaysia?
Well, it's a difficult question because you asked about Malaysia. Being very fair, Malaysia has been doing quite well, but it could be improved, yeah. In the sense that I'm glad whatever the DG has mentioned, because DG also mentioned one particular point which I always feel that this Allah has introduced more than 45 years ago, and yet we've been ignoring the social finance of it. Malaysia is doing pretty well, but we tend to work individually. The synergy, the partnership are still lacking. Whereas, you know, it's always, you know, you could be the best, but when you work together, you'll be the better of the best. What I'm saying is, especially when it comes to, I always believe why we have what we, in a short form, we call it ziswah, zakat, infaq, sadaqah, and waqaf in Islam, and it is inseparable part of economy, by the way, even of finance. In Sharia, because the very context of Sharia itself, none of us actually own what we have. What we hold, what we possess, there are rights of others. That's why I said it's inseparable. Be it individual, be it institution, you have this social aspect, obligation, but when you do it alone, we all know the power is in the number. And especially in countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, mashallah, we have those institutions which are specialized with focus on the social aspect, but they are moving on their own. And then Shariman and the industry trying to do better with the Ziswaf, but most of the funding are not with them. Imagine if these two power put together, and then you put also the people who could facilitate the like of Dr. Bello. What I mean is, you see, when we collaborate, when we actually work together as partners, because the complaint that I've been hearing from this social entities, sometimes they have issue with distribution, Sometimes they have issue with KYC, it's too burdensome, and sometimes they don't even know how to optimize the money that is in their position. These are the expertise. We know exactly where they are. It's in the banks. And we have so many Islamic banks in this region. Work together. So if there is any area that needs to be improved, and knowing the culture, the custom in the Southeast Asia, usually this has to be, you know, top-down drive. So perhaps the government, the regulator, should take the steps to encourage this. And because, you know, of course, the regulator, the banking regulator in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in most countries, they don't have the authority over this other institution, they can work with the government. But it has to be toned from the top, because otherwise it will never happen, you know. It could happen, but it will be very slow and very painstaking. But if you want it to move fast, it has to be the agenda, it has to be the focus from the government of each country. Look, we have this funding, not optimized or even worse, may not be used at all. And on the other hand, in some countries, including Indonesia, inclusion is still an issue. Poverty is still an issue. Forget about, you know, trying to actually be more green. We still have the issue of, you know, making sure there are food on the tables. So money not well utilized, the poor people who need help. And this is the thing about, I call it, I noticed some people use it blended. My preference is hybrid. Why is hybrid? Because you see, we always associate bank with commercial, right? Of course, they have the money which belongs to the stakeholders, they have to optimize. We have the zakat organization, the wakaf organization on the other hand, which have money that have been entrusted to them by the public, but not well distributed. If you can combine this, and I'm not talking out of nothing. We have done it, although not, I wouldn't say it's really optimized yet because it's more into social rather than commercial. But we have, for example, in Indonesia, what we call wakaf link sukuk, where basically we encourage the public to subscribe to the sukuk, and the money actually utilized for social purposes. Why we have to actually concentrate on this? You see, ignoring those people will not do good for the country. We have actually, during the pandemic, we should have realized how important medicine and food security is. You see, especially when there is a lockdown, you have to rely on your own. If you've been importing, if you've been actually, how are you going to survive on your own? And medicine. Not every country could actually produce themselves. But you could have the capacity within, which you have not built at the moment before the pandemic, because you have the comfort of getting it from other countries at cheaper price. Because if you have to build, you have to start in your country, it could be more pricey, but more sustainable too. But to make it less pricey, don't put it as 100% on the commercial term. Hybrid. Combined with the social aspect of it, which Islam allows anyway. That's the whole idea why we have zakat, infaq, sadaqah, and wakaf. So, yeah, partnership, strategic partnership, collaboration are still lacking, not only in Southeast Asia, actually, but since the forum is about that, this is something we should encourage, and we should actually encourage the government to come up with a policy towards that. Thank you.
Maybe Dr. Bello, I think indirectly she was hinting that I should pass the baton to you. What role do you see as regulator in that increased collaboration, increased partnership? And I think you also mentioned quite a few pillars of Islamic financial services industry. You mentioned takaful, capital markets, banking. Maybe just from your dashboard, how do you see things and how you can play a role in increasing collaboration? So the benefits of the Islamic financial services industry actually goes down to the facets of the economy, which Dr. Huria was mentioning.
All right. Thank you. I think, first of all, I wish I have the privilege of saying my mind openly in public. As a regulator, I cannot be able to do so. Like what my panelists can do, I cannot be able to do, because as a regulator and as someone that is setting standards, whatever I say is it has to be very carefully scrutinized and communicated. Now, I think the role of the regulators, maybe before I talk about the role of the regulators, I see that, I mean, we have 58 countries that are in our membership. And to be very frank and sincere, Malaysia, Indonesia has been very outstanding in terms of the ranking, in terms of the commitment by the government. I remember very well when I was in the academia, we were called upon together, the CIMB Bank, other banks, I mean financial institutions, the academic, the Ministry of Education, all this is an initiative by the Bank Negara Malaysia. We were formed into EPP7 cluster, and in order to enhance the quality of education, the employability of Islamic finance graduate, focusing more on Islamic finance. And I think that's why Dr. Rusini is saying that now they provide education and then more practitioners are going to what's that, to the universities and study in their, institute. It's because there was this initiative. There was an employability gap. The graduates are not, employable by the CIMB Bank and other banks in Malaysia. So the Bank Negara Malaysia took this initiative through the Ministry of Education Malaysia to bring all stakeholders together and to enhance the quality of curriculum at the universities. So the curriculums are now being enhanced, and that's why we have seen that. So this is one simple example of the government initiative, which the Ministry of Education really spearheaded that. Now, you talk about the BVI. This is an initiative, a pure initiative by Bank Negara Malaysia. I was involved at the beginning of this initiative as a researcher, and then when I was in INSEF, I continued the journey with that. This is aimed at ensuring the Malaysian excellence in Islamic financial service industry provision of services. It is an initiative that intended to bring value, to make the public, the consumers, understand why they have to embrace Islamic finance. We don't want people or the market practitioners or the market players promoting Islamic finance just from the faith perspective. We want them to promote it based on the economic value perspective of Islamic finance. And this is an initiative that is being driven and spearheaded greatly by the regulators. Now, where we are today is an institutions or jurisdictions whereby there is strong financial stability. That's why this growth is tremendous, and the growth has been sustainable and has been, attracting the global financial service industry stakeholders. Of course, when you talk to the marketplace, there are always some concern about what is. You cannot have everything all at once. It must be gradual. And I think where the Southeast Asian region is compared to the rest of the world, I think you are doing well. But of course, there are areas of improvement. There are rooms for enhancement in terms of the services that is being provided. We believe that has been greater coordination between some institutions, particularly financial institutions. Islamic banks now reaching out to fintech companies, partnering with fintech companies to provide some of these services. We have seen that there is also greater coordination between the other regulatory agencies and technology arms or agencies of the government to understand how best to regulate these emerging new initiatives. So I think the whole thing that is being presented as BVI, it is an initiative by the regulators, and it has been well accepted by the financial institutions. But of course, what we want to see is that we want to see more transparency from the financial institutions in disclosing the nature of the product and services that they are providing to the customers. When such information is being provided in clear terms, that will drive understanding and the industry will grow. I mean, the 8%, the 1% charge example given by my sister, Dr. Ria, is because of lack of transparency.
So we want to see more transparency from the financial institutions and then greater public awareness, and then for them to understand. When you go to any Islamic bank, you want to open an account, they will, the marketer that is working with the bank want to just get your account. So he will just give you a form. There's sign here, sign there, and then they make it easy. You think they make it easy for you without allowing you to go through the contract documentation. You don't know what is written there. So we want to have new initiatives that will be helpful to create more awareness among the customers when they are embracing. Because once they are convinced, they will be able to market this product and services to other and members of the family and so on. Now, as a regulator, I believe the financial institutions have to implement the guidelines and standards being issued by the central bank. I believe the central banks do go for supervision, do go for examination from time to time, but I think there has been not maybe a little bit more deeper, assessment, unless a bank is having some stress and there is some stress testing or some concern being raised by the market or by the institutions through their returns. Then only then they plug up something and they understand what is going on with the bank. So what we want to see is that we want to see more, yes, greater collaboration, greater coordination, but more of greater transparency and then greater initiatives and innovation. We have seen a number of financial institutions, in both Indonesia and Malaysia and some part of the region, now coming up with new innovative products and services. But we want these innovations to be put on a level playing field and being discussed, and being there is a greater consumer education on some of these things. So these are the initiative from the market perspectives that we believe will really enhance the value-based intermediation principles. It is aimed to promote not only efficiency of the financial services and the impact, but as well of course, financial inclusion in many ways, So I believe the financial institutions in the Southeast Asia region, they are very agile and very committed. But I think more transparency to let the public get to understand and do more. Now, another important area that is left untouched is the trade financing, Islamic trade financing. Currently, it's still a challenge in the region. We are talking about the Islamic economy, building an Islamic economy. We want to see more financial institutions like all the banks in the region now venturing into trade financing. Currently, the figure is disturbing. I don't want to disclose it here. All right? We want to see Islamic financial institutions coming forward to take into this space. You want to build a robust Islamic ecosystem, then the trade has to start with the trade line. So these are things that we believe that can be done and need to be done in order to be able to deliver the expected objectives and the impact of the BVI. Thank you.
Thank you, Shariman. Before we get, I think you also touched upon transparency, which is music to our ears, being a risk management professional. And I think as a regulator, I believe there are a lot of increased guidance documents that you are also providing to the industry practitioners to increase transparency. But I think from our perspective as well, transparency will definitely also improve and bring more investors. Because of greater transparency will lead to a better assessment of risk, and that will also bring more investors. I know, Shariman, you want to jump in. If you can keep it brief. I want to open and check questions from the floor as well.
Yeah, I just want to take on what Dr. Bell said about trade. So quickly, I just give anecdotally, I'll give you the problem with trade. The problem with trade is that Islamic banks do not recognize each other globally. All right. So my prior institution, you can check my background and so on, we had a conventional parent and an Islamic subsidiary. I was in the Islamic subsidiary. We wanted to do a trade finance. We were not recognized. The Islamic subsidiary of an international bank was not recognized for trade facilities. The counterparty, which happens to be an Islamic bank out of Turkey, insisted on dealing with our conventional parent because they didn't recognize the Islamic subsidiary. There is a real problem, Dr. Bello, you have put it, you have identified it very well. I think it's time for us maybe to call all the Islamic banks to KL. IFSB can organize it. We can have a talk like, what's the problem? Why can't we recognize each other? It's a very simple, basic thing. It's not a product problem, I can tell you that. The products are there. It's a recognition problem.
Thank you, Shariman. And I think we are getting close. And before we go with panel views, I wanted to check if there are any questions for the panelists in the audience. Yes, we are getting one question. Apologies if I don't read the question well, but I think it's for Dr. Bello. Diversification pace is moving fast, of which potentially create highly competitive industry. This may have adverse impact on the financial institution and market penetration. What would be the actions taken from as market practitioners, as regulators, and maybe I'll extend it to everyone as also academicians, etc. So maybe we'll start with you, Shariman. Diversification pace is moving fast. What is the impact of diversification on Islamic financial services industry?
Okay, so I'm not sure whether you're talking about diversification from a portfolio perspective or the demands of an industry. I'll just take it from the question of market demands. There's actually a lot of competing demands that we need to make a call because now we have come to the point of trade-offs. We cannot invest, I think that's an earlier point, we cannot invest in everything, we cannot focus on everything. So for us, we are data-driven and also feedback-driven. What's the feedback from the ground? What the data tells us? Where can we have most impact? So when we diversify our activity, we actually focus on those areas that can really make a material change. So I hope that answers questions.
Yeah, maybe I think it's more also on the competition side. Is there anything that is competition is healthy? Because we've seen, again, both organic growth and inorganic growth in Islamic financial services industry. So is the competition intensifying and hurting the growth, or is it benefiting the growth of Islamic financial services industry?
Right. I think we have seen recently, since before the pandemic, and then now after the pandemic, the impact or the potential growth of non-bank financial institutions. I think if I look at the diversification from that perspective, we are talking about diversification from the conventional or traditional infrastructure institutions or sectors. I think the non-bank financial institutions like the fintech, the P2P, all the crowdfunding and initiatives, these are great enablers of Islamic financial service industry growth, diversification in whatever form, if and insofar as it's well managed in terms of Sharia governance, in terms of there is a robust regulatory framework. I think that is driving growth because it is going to be healthy, definitely, and I believe the regulators, whatever framework that they are going to issue out, it must be a carefully studied framework or guidance so that that will encourage level playing field. So diversification is a competition in a way, and it also enhances growth and robust as well as stability of the institutions.
Yeah, but I can just say that at the end of the day, it will all converge because there's a reason why regulations are written in that way, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Eventually, they will
come. If the questionnaire is asking, if the person, the questionnaire is asking about divergence, not of opinion or practices, that's another different perspective of the question.
Yeah.
Because diversification is different from divergence. All right. Divergence in terms of the product and services, in terms of the Sharia harmonization issues or not lack of standardization, these are totally different things and depends on where we are today. We have seen the divergence of opinion in terms of the Sharia opinion and product and services being issued in one region compared to another region, creating, not providing the incentive to attract more investors from cross-border investment or from other jurisdictions. So that, I mean, maybe if the questionnaire is talking about divergence, I think that's another different perspective. Yes, thank you.
If
I may, I try to look at the question from the layman viewpoint, because I've been hearing people saying that, you know, especially maybe not so much in Malaysia, because Malaysia, Islamic finance has advanced and been doing fairly well. But in other countries in Southeast Asia, where Islamic finance are still, you know, like at the early stage, developing, still improving, Islamic banks are just like other banks in the sense that for the majority, they are considered for the more elite one, not for the majority people, not for the SMEs. And that's one thing. And the other thing, the other thing which also we've been hearing from the people, Islamic finance is still seen like a bank in the sense that not much different than the conventional. So diversification in this sense would be very, very much needed to cover those people that have not been covered so far, the issue of inclusion, and also to have more innovative, they embrace more better focus and better value of the Sharia itself. If I may just highlight three important reasons why we should do this. Because first of all, I mean, we've been competing, the Islamic banking industry have been competing with the conventional so much that we have overlooked our own niche market, that is the halal market. You see, look, as of last year, the trade value of OIC import to the OIC countries is 338 billion, but only 18% of those actually come from other OIC countries. So 82% from non-Muslim, from non-OIC countries. Why we don't tap into this? This is untapped market. And the SMEs in Indonesia, 99% of the of the business people are entrepreneurs. We are not helping them. When we are not helping them, we are missing out on the bigger ticket, whereas this segment has the multiplying effect. What I mean is, basically, if you're helping one small entrepreneur by half year, in first year, you may be helping only one family. But by the end of the year, within the first year, you are already helping three.
I think there's another question which is linked, and I would like to pose to Dr. Rosny, if that's okay. What do you look for and aspire in building a good professional Islamic practitioner servicing Malaysia and beyond? And this comes from an education perspective.
Okay.
Because first is education and then the practitioner. So,
thank you very much.
If you can just keep it brief, because we have a lot of questions.
Okay. Thank you very much for the question. Now, I'm looking at, of course, I did mention about the bridging between the education as well as industry. Dr. Bello mentioned about the initiative that have been taken up by the education institutions in terms of enhancing the curriculum. While we are doing that, of course, the views of the industry practitioners are taken up into consideration, and thus we can see the very enhanced curriculum now. Now, what I would like to see more is that the professional, of course, there are two ways of you going being the professionals, you know. One is, of course, you go to the corporate ladder and then you become professional. Another way is, of course, true to enhance your professionalism, to me, is that, of course, to get the highest education, what we call it, degree, for example, by having a PhD now or by having masters and whatnot. So I'm talking about a lifelong learning. Education is always something that makes you professional, because that is what has been promised by God Almighty, that when you learn, you definitely will be elevated in terms of your ranking. How, what are the elevation comes in? People respect you. You have more mind. Your mind is more useful, basically. So when we talk about professionalism, to me, it cannot be detached from education, be it in the formal and structured education, or maybe day-to-day or workplace education. So education is the essence here. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have three more questions, so a bit of a rapid fire. First question is on high rates. How, and maybe Sharman, if you can take that one, with rising rates, how will Islamic funding or banking be able to compete with conventional banking?
Yeah, I think So let me say, I think the rate environment is affects both. Not that it's not something unique to Islamic banks. It's actually a market-wide phenomenon. But to some extent, especially in both Malaysia and Indonesia, I say, because of the liquidity structure, it does impact the Islamic banks more. Now, I think the way forward, well, I will say the way forward for us is really to see what alternative forms of funding that we can introduce. That's number one. But number two is the forms. This form of alternative funding actually also plays along the strengths given to Islamic banking, right? So I think we are exploring things like investment account. What else can we do with the investment account in terms of the risk and reward structure and whatnot? But I think increasingly, as we take more risks and so on, the risk transference structure, that's also quite important.
Thank you. And I think we also published a recent research on comparing Islamic banks versus conventional banks. And what we found is, especially on the GCC side, the funding profile of GCC Islamic banks tend to be more on zero or low-cost current and savings account balance. And when the rates are rising, it tends to benefit Islamic banks' profitability, which is quite sort of strong already, and they tend to diverge more and become more profitable as compared to conventional banks. Although there are certain, let's say, exceptions currently in Saudi Arabia, where you see there's a high credit growth and deposit growth isn't keeping up. And so you're seeing a bit more convergence in Saudi Arabia when it comes to funding. And that goes to another question, which is, what is Moody's outlook for Islamic finance in 2024? I think from our perspective, Islamic finance, we measure or we track Islamic finance across four key pillars. Islamic banking, we expect this, it's been growing over the years, and we expect this growth to continue. I think it's been almost a decade or a little more where we see Islamic banking penetration in the GCC, in Malaysia, and in various other parts growing. And we expect in 2024 that growth will continue as well. The second pillar is Sukuk market, the capital market, which Dr. Bello was mentioning. And I think there's a bit of a consolidation. I started tracking Islamic finance industry in 2005. Sukuk market was barely $15 or $10 billion. In 2021, it increased to $200 billion worth of issuance. So the growth has been phenomenal. Over the last 2 years, I think generally there are a bit more headwinds, and we've seen sovereigns like Saudi Arabia, Malaysia already tapping in quite frequently. So we are not seeing a lot of new issuers in the market, but we do see that after this period of consolidation, there will be a significant growth potential. And the two last pillars, one is Takaful, which also Dr. Bello mentioned. I think we're seeing very high growth potential there. Takaful premiums have been increasing. And likewise on the supply, on the demand side for capital markets, asset management industry, which we are tracking as well. And we've written research over the last 3 weeks on all of these pillars, on banking, on Sukuk market, on Takaful, and on capital market. And across these pillars with a little bit shift in Sukuk market. Overall, the other three pillars, we expect the growth to be quite strong. So that's all we had. I think we have already overrun. Thank you so much for listening to us. Thank you to the fellow panelists for their insights. It was really insightful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.